Golf Smarter Premium number 549, published on July 19, 2016. Stay tuned to hear your name as the winner of the High Heat Driver and a new chance to win a fairway wood from KnuthGolf.com. Pete Dye disciple Bobby Weed on Tee to Green course management for golfers looking for a competitive edge.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Bobby.
Hi, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I've always had a fascination with golf course architecture as an amateur golfer. I've always wondered, like, what is it that's in your mind when you're designing something? And are you a golfer and you're looking at it that way, or are you just looking at it from a real estate perspective?
No, I'm a golfer, always have been, and you know, it's just a passion of mine. Both playing the game and being fortunate enough to work in the business for so long and be attached with so many great people. So yeah, it's a little bit of everything for me.
So, but you are a golfer.
Yes.
All right. Let's get a little bit of history, though, about how you got to become a golf course architect and you know, what the stages were for you and how you got to your company today.
Well, I mean, I played golf at an early age, and my grandparents were farmers in South Carolina, where I grew up, and my dad was in the construction business. So I guess you could say I've been playing in the dirt for a long time. And after college, I did some internships and was fortunate enough to meet Pete Dye and become associated and acquainted with him. And ultimately was fortunate enough to go to work with Pete on some projects up in on a project we were doing up in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And first project was Long Cove Club, and I also did some work at Harbortown in Hilton Head with Pete, and from there it just kind of took off, and I've been in the business ever since.
Wow. Pete Dye, where do you rank him in the annals of golf course architects?
Well, I think it's been pretty well documented. He's probably the best modern day golf course architect of his time and in our time. And I feel very fortunate to have made the acquaintance, created a relationship that's lasted over 40 years, and consider him a mentor and a personal friend.
Oh, that's really special. What kind of things do you feel like you've taken from him and brought into your own design? What kind of design elements do you admire from him and do?
I would say first and foremost is work ethic, which is very similar to the work ethic that I was raised in South Carolina. And I would say first and foremost the ability to work with a piece of ground and to continue shaping and molding features of a golf hole and really never be satisfied or content until, you know, it's really time to grasp the golf course. And and I think it's that hands-on approach that I adopted from Pete, and his work ethic, his small business way of taking on one or two jobs at a time and spending an inordinate amount of time on each specific project, giving it its due on every detail.
That's so interesting, and I completely understand as somebody who I'm a video producer. And I've been producing, you know, commercials and videos and things for many, many years. And I've always felt like the reason I love to do that is because I feel like I can keep refining it until I'm ready to say, I'm done, I'm here. So you don't just put things on paper and hand it to someone and say, build it. You're out there with your fingers in the dirt yourself.
No, we have an old saying that I got from Pete. You show me a golf course built by a set of plans, I'll show you a bad golf course. the plans are simply a guideline. And from there, you know, once you get in the field and once you have a stakeout of, you know, generally where the tees, the landing areas, and the greens are, and you've signed off on that, at that point, it really happens in the field. And that's where the hands-on approach really, really takes place.
So it's you're really refining to the very last minute before you lay down the grass. Is that the sequence?
Yeah, Pete always said the saddest day on the job site is the day they start grassing because he has to put the shovel down.
Yeah,
put the shovel and the rake down. It's almost like putting your pencil down. The test is over. Turn it in.
Yeah, I feel that way about the 17th hole of every golf course I play. It's like, oh no, we're almost done.
Right.
I want to keep going.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a labor of love, and you know, it's the only way I know how to do things because of working with Pete for many years and constantly being able to go back and either collaborate with him over time or always having access to him.
Since you've become independent, how many projects have you worked together with Pete?
Well, let's see, I left the PGA Tour in the mid-90s, and I don't know, off and on, probably we've had 8 to 10 projects that we have collaborated on, or maybe more, I'm not really sure. Someone asked me recently how many golf courses I have done, and I couldn't answer that question either.
Really?
And then somebody says, well, what's your favorite one? You know, that's kind of like asking
which is your favorite child.
Yeah, which is your favorite child? Well, you know, my stock answer is my favorite one is the one I'm working on right now.
Yeah, exactly. What's the hardest shot in golf? The next one.
Yeah, sure. Exactly.
And your term at the PGA Tour, tell me about that.
Well, that occurred when I was at Hilton Head, when we were finishing the project up there at Long Cove. And my background was agronomics, and I was also a golf course superintendent at, early on.
Okay.
So I had a lot of experience early on with construction and maintenance, which really kind of fit Pete's mold as far as bringing me on to be overseeing one of his projects. About that time, the PGA Tour had finished the Tournament Players Club at Sawgrass, the first TPC at Sawgrass. And they had just held the first tournament there, which Jerry Pate had won. And soon afterwards, we were in the condo one night in Hilton Head, and the phone rang, and it was Dean Beeman, the commissioner of the PGA Tour, calling Pete, basically saying, and I could only hear one side of the conversation, obviously, and it was something to the effect from Pete's side was, yes, sir, I understand, yes, I understand, we'll get somebody down there, I've got a guy right here, we're just about finishing up, and I got this young kid, Bobby Weed, I'll send him on down there. So he got off the phone, and he says, well, that was Dean Beeman, and they've got some issues down there with the Tournament Players Club and going to have to make some changes. And I just volunteered you to go down there and take over and make the changes and straighten it all out.
What did you respond with?
I'm like, well, that sounded like a great opportunity to me. And that was in,
absolutely.
That was in 1982. So at the end of 82, I moved down to Ponte Vedra Beach, and I've never left. Started work there at the Tournament Players Club, rebuilding and making changes to the golf course, of which we rebuilt, I don't know, 3 or 4 times. Pete's always said it looks like they should have about 90 holes down there. And but we have continued to modify and ultimately polish the old gym. And it's a really good golf course today, and they continue to make some changes That's the one thing about golf courses. You know, Donald Ross lived at close by, really adjacent to the number two course at Pinehurst where he lived, and he constantly made changes to that golf course. And we've done something similar to the Players Club here at Sawgrass as well. So I started there and stayed with the tour. Created their in-house construction services division, and then became their in-house design coordinator and was their chief designer and built a number of TPCs for the PGA Tour, and ultimately left in 96 after, say, about 13 years or so. That's actually when I went out on my own.
I'm fascinated to find out from you what the difference is from a design perspective of designing a course for PGA Tour players versus designing a course for recreational players?
Well, that's an interesting question. I will say that the tour players are all on scholarship. So you're really building the golf course for the members, unless maybe it's a tournament players club course. But even then, they're only playing the golf course 1 week a year. So you have to strike a balance. More often than not, we have to build this golf course for somebody that's a paying member, whether it be a resort, private, public golf course. And the PGA Tour comes through once a year. So they're only playing the golf course for 1 week of the 1 week a year. So you've got to build a golf course, and that's really the challenge. Is you have to build a golf course that is going to accommodate 51 weeks of the year of regular play.
Sorry, my dog's barking.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, but it's got to be a very difficult challenge for you, because finding that balance is not always going to be easy. Plus, with the amount of extra real estate that you need for a course that's going to be on the tour once a year, once every 5 years, maybe once in its lifetime, just so they can say it's been on the tour, you need a lot of extra real estate, don't you?
Well, tees are relatively easy to find. Tees are easy enough to find and add yardage. For a tournament, typically in the United States, they grow the rough up, they mow the greens down, and they firm them up as much as they can. You can alter the golf course to some degree, some more than others, to prep it for a tournament. But at the same time, you want to be able to build your greens to where you have some good tournament pin placements. And, you know, we try to build our courses from a strategic point of view, and also have some risk and reward. And typically, you know, with the setup of the golf course and altering that setup for the tournament, and added yardage and the other items that I mentioned, you can typically juice it up to where you're going to challenge these tour players. Now, when you get to some of the tournament player club courses, they're built for tournaments, and they're much bigger and larger venue. And those type of golf courses require a lot more infrastructure. I mean, if you're going to host an event on any golf course year after year, you're going to have to build in more infrastructure. You need more width. You need more acreage. Obviously, you need the parking. You need the hospitality opportunities. You need the concessionaires. You need a lot of room. The TV compound, the miles and miles of underground wiring, the more heavy, wider cart paths to accommodate more traffic. than your normal golf courses. So, you know, if it's a Tournament Players Club golf course, the PGA Tour has a definite set of specifications that will accommodate a tour course built for the tour over a number of years. Now, if you and I belong to a regular country club and we want to host an event, well, there are going to be some concessions made because obviously that golf course was not designed or built to accommodate a big tournament. So there has to be some concessions made, and oftentimes, like at Marion, even Marion for a major, you know, they lack concession, they lack hospitality areas. So they, you know, you typically have to spend a lot more money in prepping and setup, whereas a tournament players club golf course, most of that infrastructure is built in from the very beginning. It's different building it in from the beginning versus hosting an event at a country club that really wasn't designed to host tournaments. So the infrastructure changes are significantly different.
Hmm. So just between the two of us, when you get the opportunity to design a course that you know is going to be on the tour, is that an exciting creative challenge, or is that an annoyance?
Oh, no, it's exciting. I was able to do a number of tournament player club courses when I was associated with the PGA Tour. So, I really like the challenge because you are building a golf course to challenge the best golfers in the world, the expert golfers that make up less than 1% of the game. But they seem to get a lot of the ink, and they get all the ink and all the press.
Yes, so, they do.
So, it's a challenge, and we put a lot of effort into all of our golf courses. But I think where you start is one of the first questions is, who are you building the golf course for?
Sure.
And if it is for the tournament player, then absolutely, you think about it a little bit differently. But at the same time, the pros are playing the ball in the air. The amateurs, for the most part, are finding ways to run the ball into the green, bounce the ball up. They play more of a ground game. The tour players play the game in the air. So not having forced carries throughout the golf course is going to help the amateur players. And at the same time, for the most part, the tour pros, it doesn't bother them. What's going to get them is some illusion, some deception, half par golf holes, anything that makes them a little bit uncomfortable. And wherever you can bring a good balance of the mental side of the game. I mean, if you can have a good balance of mental agility and physical ability, that's the kind of mix that you want. And you can do a lot with your greens, with your contours, with some pins that you can tuck a little bit more in the corners. Obviously, good strategic bunkering. That's why I think Pete's golf courses have always set up good to accommodate every caliber of golfer, because in a lot of instances that you can bite off as much of the hazard as you so desire. Amateurs can take the safe way home. The pros will challenge those longer linear lines a little bit more. And I think that's one of the reasons Pete's golf courses have been so intriguing. And we endorse that as well going forward today. And some architects just put continuous bunkers, more and more bunkers out there down the left side or down the right side, and add another bunker behind the last bunker that was built. and back the tees up a little bit more. So I think everybody is constantly looking at ways to update, upgrade the golf courses to really combat what seems to be a length that has no end.
You said create illusions and deception and half par. Is that what you said?
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with that term.
Half par holes are the best holes in golf. Where say you have a drivable par four, 325 yard par four, that would be a par 3.5. And if you have a par three of 255 yards, I'm going to call that a par 3.5.
I see.
If you have a par five of 535 yards, I'm going to call that a par 4.5. Half par holes, number one, half par holes are the best holes for match play. Half par holes, I think, are the most interesting golf holes there are. And I think the more half par holes that you have, the more indecision you bring into the game. And that's the mental side that I think we need to incorporate more into designs of today.
That is so interesting. I've never heard that, but it makes so much sense. And I can see where on a tour side, that would be a great challenge that you have to do. But on the amateur side, it would be a great frustration from the amateur player, but a great challenge for you as well.
Well, I mean, that's why we have handicaps, too.
Sure.
So, I mean, it really balances out, and it gives you the same opportunity and the same challenge as an amateur as it does for the pros.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm all for bifurcation, but yeah, I can see what you mean. When players are complaining about a golf course, what is it that they're complaining about? That the short game is too hard, that the angles are wrong, that something that the way the maintenance is being done, or that the designer created it?
I think it's a combination of things. Sometimes they don't like to be made uncomfortable.
Well, the rest of us are.
Exactly. On a daily basis.
Yeah, screw them.
Most amateurs are. Tour pros, they, at the bottom line is, if they're not shooting good scores, if you want a tour player to say something really good about your golf course, typically them shooting a good score will result in some good comments. Going forward, I think that challenging golf courses, but fair golf courses, and that's a tough balance sometimes to reach. And I think the ebb and flow of a design and of a golf course creates that during the round of golf. It's okay to step on the gas and have a couple of hard holes, a stretch of hard holes, back off with something like a half par hole, and then step back on the gas as you go around the round. I mean, you kind of feel like you have a stretch of holes where if you can hang on, and there's going to be some other holes that you can really be aggressive and go after. So players, players prefer golf courses that are predictable. Mm-hmm. Unpredictability raises some concern with those guys. It gets them out of their comfort zone, and that's not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. You're talking about the best golfers in the world. They can handle this. But sometimes you can make them a little bit uncomfortable with features and some of the deception and some of the illusions that you can still create by disguising the green from the landing area to the green by putting a low or maybe a little rise in between those areas to where you know what the yardage is, but sometimes it looks a little closer or it may look a little farther away. And anytime you bring in indecision into a player's mind, and now all of a sudden he has to put his hand on one or two different clubs and he's not certain, that level of uncertainty is the mental side of the game that I think is so important. They all have the physical ability. Some are a little bit sharper from a mental standpoint. And in some instances, they get out of their comfort zone. And then again, you know, you may have some greens that may have too much contour in them, or they have too much speed to them, and you're constantly putting defensively. For example, I think a lot of the greens at Oakmont a couple weeks ago, they're so fast and they have contour until a lot of the guys are putting defensively. You know, it's very difficult to be aggressive on a birdie putt that's got 3, 4, and 5 foot of break. You know, you're not going to make those putts very often, and you start putting very defensively, and you're really just trying to lag it, and that makes them uncomfortable. That's not their comfort level as a tour pro. So I mean, as fast as the greens are today, we're having to put a little less contour in them. You know, we were building greens 20, 25 years ago that we were cupping 4 plus percent. And today you find more greens being cuppable at 2 and 3% because the stimp meter and the speed of the greens is so much faster today. So it's a combination of all those things that we're talking about here that will emit a comment, pros or cons, on a golf course from a pro's perspective.
Okay, now define cuppable. What you meant when you said when it's cuppable, the green.
Yeah, I'm talking about percent of slope on a green determines the cuppability. You're not gonna cup a 4% slope or 5% slope. That's an uncuppable location for a cup. To put a pin on a green that's got 4 and 5% slope and rolling at stimping at a speed of 12 or 13 or 14, first off, the ball's not gonna stop. And you know, they're just going to go back and forth until finally the ball finds the cup.
Yeah.
And that makes everybody look pretty silly, including the setup guys, rules officials, and mostly the players. So, where you could maybe cup 4% 20, 25 years ago, you really can't cup 4% today.
So what is a, I'm sorry, I got distracted. What is, easier, or let me put it this way. What is the difference of designing a course, a public course, a private course, a resort course, and maybe even a course that's going to end up on the tour at some point? Is there a difference from your perspective in design?
Well, I think it all starts with the owner, who you're building the golf course for. I always say a more involved owner, a more informed owner, results in a better golf course. And knowing who you're building the golf course for is extremely important. And how the golf course is going to be maintained. I think it's very important to understand the correlation between design and maintenance. In my opinion, design complements maintenance, and maintenance complements design. You really can't have one without the other. I've seen some really great design golf courses in very poor condition, and you know, they never reach their potential. And I've seen golf courses that are less than desirable design, but maintained in impeccable condition. But boy, I tell you, when you get the balance of both of them right, you get a good design and you get it maintained to a high level. That's noteworthy. You know, it doesn't. To me, we're trying to build as good a golf course as possible. Whether it be public, private, or resort. And, you know, it really starts with the piece of ground that you're given with, what type of constraints you have, the budget that you have to work with, and the owner that you're building the golf course for, and who's playing the golf course. So there's a lot of factors that go in. I think the overall objective is the same all the time. There's so many variables that go into any of these golf courses, whether it be private, public, or resort.
And what do you prefer, redesign, a renovation, or starting from scratch?
Well, seeing that we're not building many new courses today.
No, we're not. We haven't for almost 10 years now, right?
And that's going to continue. It's pretty obvious that we overbuilt golf. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that we have a significant attrition of golfers. I just think we built too many golf courses. The number of golfers, I don't think has dwindled as much as people may think. Hmm. I think we may have just overbuilt the golf courses, and we're seeing the market kind of come back into the middle. And I think you're going to continue to see more attrition of golf courses in the future. I think we've got a few more years to go. But I don't think the number of golfers have dwindled that much. You can only have so many golfers, just like you can only have so many skiers, and you can have on a ski slope. At some point, you reach this level that. That's what it is. Number of golfers to the number of golf courses, and that ratio I think may have gotten a little bit out of balance over the years, and we're just seeing a correction right now. Okay. I think the game is healthy. It's exciting. The game is being played in more parts of the world than ever before, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. Golf is being televised more. We're getting more golf TV time than ever before.
Sure. And dedicated networks.
That's a good thing. That can't help but to assist and continue to grow the game. All of the allied associations are, they've got their heart in the right place. They're, everybody's trying to grow the game. There's a lot of initiatives out there to grow the game. I think we all understand that the game is at some point has gotten a little too costly. We need to make it more cost efficient. I think we understand that, people have less disposable time and they have less disposable income today. And we need to adapt to that. We need to build our golf courses to accommodate some of that going forward. So there's a lot that is changing from a business standpoint in the game of golf. I think we're going to continue to alter the way we design and build golf courses, who's playing these golf courses. And the challenge for us as well is the range of golfers continues to grow. As I said earlier, the beginner starts down here at the basement level, and the expert golfer ceiling just keeps getting higher and higher. So that range of golfers is challenging from our standpoint, from a design perspective. But it's a great challenge, and I think the game of golf is healthy and will continue to grow, and we'll get through this correction, and I think we'll be fine.
Has anyone ever approached you about doing three loops of six as opposed to two nines?
Oh, sure.
And why is that not? Because everyone talks about how costly in time golf is, and that our lives are so full and there's so much going on that people don't have enough time to play golf. So instead of two nines, why not play six or 12?
Hey,
What's your thought about it?
I think as long as you're out there, I think it's a good thing. I'm not of the opinion that we need to reinvent the wheel with 12-hole courses or 14-hole courses. I think 9 holes of golf, I think we should have more 9-hole golf courses.
Yeah.
And if the routing and the land allows you to do a three six-hole loops that come back, I think that's fine. I have no problem with that. If you're not forcing it on the ground and you can do three loops of sixes for an 18-hole golf course, great. The nine-hole golf courses, the nine-hole loops, I don't know why we don't promote and build more nine-hole golf courses.
Well, we did an episode a number of weeks back about a course in Thailand that is three loops of six. Mm-hmm. I've not heard of any other courses that are like that. Do you know of any?
Not off the top of my head, but I'm sure there are plenty of them out there.
I think it would be great. I'd love to be able to go ahead and do it that way, to play. If I, you know, I'm not a country club member, so if I just want to go out for an hour and a half and play six, fine. But I'd rather play 18. And this course has two par threes, two par fours, two par fives on each six. And it's a par 72.
You know what? I'm all for that. We just built a short course.
I wish I could hire you to build a course.
Yes. We just built a nine-hole short course on 8 acres. 8 acres. We basically...
That's small, isn't it?
Eight acres like really is about small. The size of a normal driving range. And wow. we built a little short course. And you can really play it with, you know, you take your wedge, take your gap wedge and a sand wedge and a putter, say three or four clubs.
So that's all par threes.
All par threes.
An executive style course.
Very much so. But you can play it clockwise and you can play it counterclockwise. And if it's not too busy, you can play cross country. And, you know, that type of innovation. And I will tell you that I was playing it with Lanny Watkins recently. Lanny and I played nine holes.
Where is this?
This is in outside of Bristol, Virginia, in the extreme southwest corner of Virginia, at a private club called the Old Farm that we built back around 2000. And we were both saying that if you played and practiced on that little short course every day, that, I mean, you're talking about 100-yard shots, 115, 125-yard shots down to 70-yard shots. If you worked and played on that golf course every day while you were out there working on your game, you know, the game is all about 100 yards in.
Absolutely.
It really is. Those guys out there are so good. Dustin Johnson is bombing it right now off the tee, hitting that little baby cut off the tee. But what he and Butch Harmon are really working on is distance control with the wedges. And from 125 yards in, and maybe in some of these instances with the pros, 150 yards in, but those short irons, when you can really get that dialed in and then be able to get it up and down from around these greens, you know, practicing on a little course like that as part of your routine would be outstanding.
Well, listen, I don't want to take up a whole lot more of your time. I know it's very late for you in the East. But I would love to get some advice from you for the average golfer. Are you still with me? I'm not sure. Oh, there you are.
Okay, all back.
Then let's wrap this up quickly. So,
yeah. I need a glass of wine or something.
Don't you, shot of whiskey? Don't you love technology?
Oh man,
it's supposed to make our life easier.
That's why I'm a dirt farmer. I'll tell you. People, you know, sometimes you get on an airplane and, you know, somebody finds out that you're a golf course architect, you will not get anything done. You will not get anything done.
No.
You'll end up talking the entire flight. But if somebody asks me and I kind of have a sense that they could be golfers and I've got lots of work to do for the next 2 or 3 hours on a plane trip, if they ask you what you do and if I just say I'm a dirt farmer, that ends the conversation.
Sure. I had a friend that was an executive at a Major League Baseball team, and he said whenever he was on a flight, he told people he sold insurance. And that was the end of the conversation. He would never say, oh, yeah, I do vice president of marketing for a Major League Baseball team, because he knows he would never get out of that.
No.
Oh, God. All right. Well, let me wrap this up. And I appreciate your efforts on trying to get Skype to continue to work. Multiple locations at the very least. So from a design perspective, when the amateur golfer is standing on the tee box, what should we be looking at? What kind of advice did Pete Dye give you to design into courses? What kind of advice can you give us as recreational golfers on how to be, well, dare I say, smarter golfers by looking at what the architect has done?
You should be able to stand on the tee and know what's in front of you as whether the hole is asking you to hit it right to left or left to right. I'm not saying that a hole has to that you play a hole one time and you know how to do it. I'm not saying that. I think it's okay for a hole to have a couple of secrets, and the more you play it, the more you understand it. But more often than not, when you stand on the tee, you should be able to look out there and see some hazards and know whether you need to, the hole is asking you to hit it right to left or left to right. And then the same thing into the green. If you hit a tee shot out there, if your bunkers are on the left, that's basically a right to left hole. Tee shot. If the bunker's on the right, basically it's a left to right tee shot. And more often than not, from a strategic design perspective, if the closer you skirt that bunker, you should have a better shot into the green. If you don't challenge those hazards, if you don't challenge those bunkers off the tee, then you have deferred. It's kind of like deferred strategy. You have deferred and made your second shot a little more challenging into the green. Now, some players understand that better than others, but more often than not, for the amateur golfer, we're trying to give you a little more room out there in the landing area. And the longer you hit it, okay, I'm saying maybe. We're going to tighten up those hazards on out there for a longer distance player. But at the end of the day, you should feel comfortable on the tee that you can see what the design is asking you to do, whether it's the necessity to hit it right to left off the tee or a left to right off the tee, and then vice versa into the green, I think is a mark of a good design. For an amateur player and all the way down to the expert players. And it's okay. I mean, it's okay to have some blind features in a golf hole. A hole is only blind once.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about it. I think the more you play a golf hole or a particular golf course, the more you'll understand it. I think it's nice to be able to play around the golf and go back and recall all of the golf holes. I think that's the mark of a great golf course, when you can go back and recreate and remember the holes after you've played, instead of them all being, you know, vanilla or the same type of holes. I think variety and interest creates options. And I think that's the essence of good design, day in and day out.
But what about, like, for resort courses where you may get to play it or rarely get to play it twice, you get to go. Is it something that you would design blind shots for the amateur in that case?
Well, on a resort golf course, chances are you may have a more interesting piece of property potentially.
Okay. Sure.
You may have the latitude to be a little more creative. Mm-hmm. You may take more advantage of some of the topography opportunities or vegetation opportunities. You might have an opportunity to build more water and make it, not only make it challenging, but make it visually appealing. For resort golf courses, because typically on a resort golf course, you're going there, you're spending money, you're going there, you're taking your family, it's a special occasion, and you want it to be, you want it to be a more special golf course. Typically they're more compelling sites more often than not.
And you want to shoot well. I mean, you'd if you're a 12 handicap and you shoot in the, you know, in the low to mid 80s on a regular basis, right, you're not going to want to go to a resort and shoot 95. You'll be frustrated. You'll walk away saying you hate that course. But if you shoot an 81, you're like, yeah, that was awesome. I loved it.
I don't think there's any question about that. That's human nature.
Yeah, sure. I played Bandon Dunes, and it was the most frustrating time in my life. It felt like there were hair dryers on either side of my head for 4 hours. The wind was unbelievable. The course was difficult, and I hated it until I got home and started looking at the pictures thinking, oh, my God, that was amazing.
Right, right. When can I go back?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Sure, that's good.
Well, Bobby, this has been a college course, listening to you and being able to ask you these questions. I really appreciate your time and your effort for staying online with me. BobbyWeed.com, BobbyWeed, BobbyWeed.com. If you want to learn more about what Bobby does, where he does it, I'm sure if you'd like to hire him, he's willing to listen.
That's right. Thanks, Fred.
You're welcome, Bobby. Thank you so much for your time. So I want to apologize to those of you who plan to watch this episode on Golf Smarter TV. The video feed was just completely out of sync. The video and audio were all whacked out on Skype. I don't know why it happened, but I'm going to try to make sure it never happens again. So I think we should get right to our call with Dean Knuth to see who's won that customized high heat driver. Hey, Dean, welcome back to Golf Smarter.
Thanks very much, Fred. It's great to be back.
How things have been going? Have you been hearing from the Golf Smarter community at all?
We have, actually. High heat is in use by Golf Smarter listeners, and we've gotten wonderful reviews back from on the driver, the 3-wood, the hybrid. It's really great.
Oh, that's fabulous. Congratulations. Hey, did I just read something in Golf Magazine about you?
Yeah.
What happened?
They announced the best innovators in the game of golf, and somehow they selected me as the only golf club designer, as the best innovator in golf.
Wow. I'm kind of dumbfounded. That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's such great news. That's definitely going to have some impact on your sales, I hope.
I would think it would add to credibility that people say, hey, maybe there's really something here when you win such a prestigious award.
Yeah, yeah, that's really nice. Oh, I'm really happy for you, and I'm so glad that we were able to announce that here and to share that with the Golf Smarter community. Just gives a little more validity to what we've been talking about on your clubs.
Thank you.
That is great. That's great.
Hey, Fred, before we do the drawing.
Yeah.
Your show is so dynamic, and it's so good for the game of golf.
Oh, thank you.
We're going to come back again in a month, and this time give away a high heat 3-wood, which just won Best Product Award from the International Network of Golf.
Wow. And the ING conference, which we saw each other and I got to hit the clubs for the first time. We've been talking a lot about them, and that's very, that's exciting news. Well, thank you. So here we go again. 4 weeks for Golf Smarter listeners. Deadline for entry, I guess, would be like August 21st, Sunday, August 21st. Enter again. And if you've already entered, you can enter again. We're going to start from scratch here. And Dean, thank you very much for again offering to give away a 3-wood this time.
Thank you. I think whoever gets it is going to be absolutely blown away by how long and straight it is off the deck.
And you're not just sending a random 3-wood or driver to these winners. You have a fitting process for them, right?
Right. Yes, they will be contacted by our fitter to make sure that based on their swing, that they're getting the right combination of loft and shaft.
Perfect. That's great. Well, the reason we're here today is to give away a high heat driver. You guys have been so generous in offering to our audience the opportunity to win a driver. And I think the way we should do this is I have sorted all the names, and I did a sort based on mailing address. So it's not alphabetical. It's not when they, you know, by first name or last name, and it's not when they entered. It's just this random sorting of a mailing address, not email, but their mailing address. And so I'm going to ask you to pick a number between 1 and 95, and we'll see who just won.
Okay. Well, that would be number 47.
And why did you pick 47? I'm curious.
That happens to be the year of my birth. I'm a very old man.
Oh, not older than my siblings. Well, congratulations. Thank you for picking 47, because Brian Steffen of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, has just won a brand new high heat driver. Congratulations, Brian. And Brian, thank you so much for entering. And thank you again, as always, to Brian and everyone else. Thanks so much for listening to the Golf Smarter podcast. And Brian, you should know that you are not eligible to win the high heat 3-wood. But let me tell you, once you start hitting your new driver, you're going to be really interested in putting the 3-wood and the hybrid in your bag. And remember, when you're talking to Steve at Knuth Golf about your order, or any of you, make sure to mention that you heard about them on Golf Smarter, because you're going to get an exclusive discount. Now, deadline to register to win the High Heat 3-wood is Sunday, August 14th at midnight, and we will select a winner on episode 553, published on August 16th. Everybody can register. If you notice, there's a really good chance of winning, because not many people are registering to win. And if you have registered, you're going to have to register again. So click on the contest banner in our featured section at golfsmarter.com.